Time for your lawn and garden questions on Focus today as we head into spring. All the snow has melted from that big snowstorm of a few weeks back. Grass is getting green, insects are returning, and plants in your garden may already be coming up. Sandy Mason is here today to handle any questions you have about what's growing or not growing in your lawn and garden. Plus, our second guest today may have the device that answers the age-old question of, when does my plant need watering? Eduardo Torrealba is a local entrepreneur who's come up with a device that senses soil moisture levels and sends a signal through a special website to your phone or computer telling you when it's time to water. Is this the plant watering solution you've been looking for? Decide for yourself. And if you have your own method of checking when it's time to water, let us know about it. I'm Jim Meadows, and our next hour on Focus is devoted to your lawn and gardening questions after this hour's news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Sandy Mason from the University of Illinois Extension is back today to take your lawn and gardening questions. Good morning, Sandy.
Good morning.
And we have a special guest on the program this morning who believes he has a special answer to an old problem deciding when it's time to water your plant. He's Eduardo Torrealba, and he and his associates, all former University of Illinois students, have come up with a device they call PlantLink. Eduardo, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
And, you know, of all the engineering questions you could have tackled, what inspired you to tackle this one?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, my wife and I moved here from Texas in August of 2011, and I was starting graduate school here at the University of Illinois. And during that time, you know, we'd moved into an apartment and we had started doing more cooking. And so we wanted to have a few, you know, spices and herbs that we could grow in our own kitchen. So we got a basil plant and the basil plant started dying and we tried to figure out what we were doing wrong. And we learned that we were over and under watering it. And so
both over and under.
Yeah, we'd kind of go back and forth. You know, it'd be okay for a little while and then we'd overwater it and then we'd pull that back and then we'd underwater it. And it was kind of a vicious cycle. So started looking for a solution for something that would, you know, tell us if we were watering it correctly or incorrectly and kind of give us a little bit of information. We're both engineers and we kind of like to have data, right? You know, that's a big thing for us. So went out to a bunch of different stores, looked online, couldn't really find something that solved the problem the way that I wanted it solved. And so I ended up just building a solution using some electronics that I'd worked with in the past on other projects. And once I had that solution working, you know, it would just send an alert to my cell phone depending on the moisture level in the soil. And I figured out what it needed to be for the basil plant. And then, you know, I started thinking about all the other people out there that had, you know, lawns and gardens and had this issue with incorrectly watering things. And overwatering in particular was a big deal for me because, you know, I had a lot of interest in water resource management and access around the world. You know, there are more than a billion people that don't have any access to clean water. And here in the United States, we use a huge percentage of our water resources to water our lawns and gardens. And I wanted to make sure that that was being used, you know, wisely. So, you know, looked into it, found out it was a big problem for lots of other people, had a prototype, pulled together a team. We decided to build a business around the product. And, you know, here we are today.
So essentially, you're calling the device PlantLink.
That's right.
And what is it? What is it the consumer buys when he buys PlantLink?
Yeah. So when the consumer buys PlantLink, they can get you know, they get the one base station, which is the device that you plug into your router in your house, and then that wirelessly communicates to the sensors or the links is what we call them, and you put those links next to your plants, and you can get as many of those as you want for different plants.
And these are, they're essentially cylinders with little prongs, couple prongs down at the bottom.
That's right. They're not very large. You know, they're maybe a couple inches tall and the prongs go in a few inches into the soil. You know, the average root depth for most plants is just in the first few inches there. So we can detect the moisture in that soil and send that information back to that base station. That communicates with our website, and then it can push alerts to you through your cell phone or the web page or email or calendar notifications, however you want to be notified about, you know, watering your plants. It can generate dynamic schedules, take into account the future weather patterns that might be coming through to prevent you from watering if it, you know, maybe has a 90% chance of rain in 2 days. The other thing that we're really excited about is a smart valve that we've developed. You can hook this up to a sprinkler or a drip irrigation hose or a soaker hose or something like that. And then when the links that are associated with that valve indicate that the plants need to be watered, the valve comes on, waters the plants for you, and then shuts off. So it effectively does automatic watering for you, which can be perfect for, you know, a flower bed or something with a lot of plants that have similar moisture requirements.
And so each of these sensors would be customized to the particular species of planta.
That's correct. You would take those sensors, and during the setup, you would say, you know, this sensor goes with my rosebush, or this sensor goes with my, you know, my basil plant, or whatever it would be that you're associating it with.
How many plants have you programmed for?
You know, right now we're developing a database, and we're doing most of that from kind of a top-down level. So we'll look at different, you know, species of plants, and then figure out the amount of water that those species need, and then classify individual plants by species so that we can get a good recommendation for the watering needs of those types of plants. And then in the future, we'll try to do even more granularity so that we have more precise information for customers.
Now, are there already moisture sensing devices out on the market that you'll be competing with?
Yeah, you know, there are a few different sensors that are out there. You can go to, you know, Lowe's or Home Depot right now and buy these sensors that you can put into the soil next to your plant, and they'll give you a reading of between 0 and 100% saturation. But the problem with that is that unless you know exactly what the saturation level your specific plants need, it doesn't really give you enough information. And a lot of people actually misuse those devices and just put it in there and then fill it up with, you know, water until it hits 100%. And then at that point, they're overwatering those plants and, you know, misusing the device. So we're trying to avoid that problem. And, you know, there's nothing else out there that really gives you that automatic watering schedule reminders the way that our system does.
Now, did you pull together existing technology for PlantLink, or is there any new proprietary, maybe patentable technology that you're working with?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a mix. You know, the team of engineers that we have a lot of mechanical and electrical engineering experience, but not a lot of agricultural engineering experience. So instead of trying to reinvent the way that soil moisture readings are taken, we use some proven technologies that have been around since the 50s or 60s as the actual sensing method. And then we built our own custom wireless network mechanism on top of that, using a protocol called Zigbee, if any of your listeners are familiar with that, that does short-range wireless. So from there, you know, it's a customized implementation of existing technologies, to answer your question.
Now, Sandy Mason, I'm just wondering, this question of how much to water what plants, this is something that a lot of gardeners run up against trying to figure out?
Oh, absolutely. And actually, one of the things, one of the authors, Roger Swain, he's a garden author, I always think of his quote. He always says that good gardeners are just better waterers. And I think that a lot of that is absolutely true, as once people understand their plants, their soil, the weather, all that kind of stuff, they're just better at knowing when to water so the plants don't go through stress or they don't get overwatered or underwatered kind of thing. So I think this goes to a lot of how plants are taken care of, is how well they're watered.
And so it's just a matter of knowing the plant and knowing the soil conditions and being able to figure out how moist the soil is.
And it really is one of those things, we can't really give a recipe. You know, I know people would like to say, you know, gee, if I could just know that I could just water every Monday and I'd be fine. Well, it doesn't really work that way, especially outdoors, because of the soil conditions are so different. Some, if you have high clay content soils, tend to hang on to moisture longer than if you have really well-drained sandy soils. So you have to understand your soil, the individual plants, a fern, you know, really needs to be watered, and it's not very forgiving if it dries out. But yet some other plants, you know, are fine if they dry out a little bit. They're fine. They go on their merry way. So it's understanding. So it's all those variables. It's really hard, I think, for new gardeners, especially to understand, you know, how do I water? Because no one can really give me this recipe.
You know, one of the lower tech devices I've seen out there are these globes, these glass globes on stems. You fill them with water, you invert it into the soil, and I guess it just releases water into the soil, probably up to 100% saturation, and it essentially keeps it there?
Yeah, those are actually really good, I think, especially for houseplants. If you have ferns or something like that, houseplants, where you just, they're not forgiving. I mean, it'll just dry up if you don't keep it watered. So I think they're good for that, or if you're going on vacation. But those are pretty short-term kinds of things. But it does work, especially if you're going away for a few days and you're worried about whether that plant's going to get watered or not. So it's probably not a long-term solution.
And is that best for a plant that really needs a high moisture content?
Yeah, and probably ones that are certainly unforgiving. Or if you happen to be one of those, you know, houseplant people that just forgets to water, you know, they go month on end and you forget to water, it's probably a really good one for that. But it really doesn't go to 100% saturation. It's pretty much as the soil dries out, then that water sort of leaches into the soil.
I was wondering, Eduardo, when you were first struggling with the herb plants back at the apartment, did you go through the little glass globe phase?
You know, I looked at it, but we had a pretty small basil plant, and the glass globes I was finding out there were a little bit too big for it.
So,
yeah, we didn't end up doing that. But I have seen that before, yeah.
Okay. Is now PlantLink, is it on the market now?
It's available for pre-order, so we're actually going through the process of manufacturing PlantLink right now. We just ran a Kickstarter campaign, if your listeners are familiar with that. Kickstarter is this online site, kickstarter.com, where you can go and back projects that people are running, you know, products like PlantLink, or there could be people who are trying to release new CDs. They're just trying to raise funding to do these things. So we did a Kickstarter for PlantLink in January, and we raised just under $100,000 to be able to take the product to manufacturing. And then just this past week, we launched myplantlink.com, where your listeners can go, and they can also get in on pre-ordering if they happen to miss out on the Kickstarter campaign. And then those should be shipping sometime this summer if you were a Kickstarter backer, or sometime early this fall if you are just getting in on pre-orders right now.
And I should say that myplantlink.com, yes, that's the link, is linked to our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. This is not an endorsement or an advertisement for PlantLink, but if you're curious to see how this particular approach to watering plants works, the link is there on our website. And we welcome you to the conversation. If you have a lawn or gardening question or advice about plant watering, call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, toll free at 1-800-222-WILL. And you can also email us at will-talk, that's W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. And we welcome your questions as well on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. The PlantLink devices, your setup, your company, which I understand is Oso Technologies.
That's correct.
And what was is there a meaning behind that particular name?
Yeah, so Oso is the Spanish word for bear, and quite a few of the people in our company are actually graduates of Baylor University down in Texas. And our mascot there was the Bears, so it was kind of an easy association.
It's interesting, but a lot of you folks came up to Illinois for what, graduate school?
Yeah, for graduate school. You know, Illinois has a fantastic engineering college, and we were all students that wanted to do something more after undergrad and decided to come here for graduate school.
Now, you're at the Research Park on the University of Illinois campus on the Champaign side.
Yeah.
In the Enterprise Works building. Are you making the devices, the PlantLink devices there?
No, we're doing engineering, you know, design and some testing there, but the actual manufacturing is going to be happening at a number of different places here in central Illinois. So we have an injection molding place that does work out in Paxton, Illinois, called PDI. And then we're working with a couple of different electronic pick and place and assembly houses here, one in Jacksonville, one in Bloomington, to, you know, look into the process of getting our devices assembled completely for us.
And I'm just wondering, once you had these devices in place, how did your basil plants do?
You know, the basil plant got a lot better, and then I got a lot busier, and then the basil plant didn't get a lot better after that. And now, you know, we recently moved into a house, and we got a cat, and the cat just doesn't play well with houseplants. So we have hope for our garden that we're going to plant this spring outside.
And that's a question. Would these sensors, do you think, be prone to mischief from animals at Roman gardens?
No, the sensors should be very robust. You shouldn't have any issues with something like that. They're designed to go outside. You know, they'll be sealed. There shouldn't be any issues with anything like that.
Can they stay out there all year round through the winter?
They, you know, they're going to be designed for, you know, better weather than absolute freezing cold temperatures. What we'll probably do is have the devices alert you whenever the weather says that it's about to start freezing and remind you to go pull your PlantLink system from your yard and maybe even, you know, do some care and get your garden ready for the winter as well, besides just pulling the devices themselves.
Okay. You're in the pre-ordering phase right now. Are you seeing much interest at this point?
Yeah, we are. We've had around 1,000 people pre-order the systems here in the last few months, and so that's been very encouraging for us.
Do you have a target number that you'd like to get for to start manufacturing?
No, so we're moving into manufacturing right now with the number of customers that we already have. And then from there, you know, we'll try to increase our profile, you know, do more advertising, maybe get PlantLink into some home garden stores, that kind of thing.
Okay, you haven't, no TV campaign yet, huh?
No, not yet.
Sandy, I was wondering, are there any methods, techniques, or devices besides the glass globes we were talking about that people use to try to try to get their watering right?
You know, there are a lot of things out there, but I think I guess a couple of things. The only ones that I've seen, at least in that have been effective, tend to be the ones that are pretty expensive. To the point where probably the average home gardener, at least in the past, probably wasn't too interested in. Those less expensive ones that you get in some of the box stores and stuff, it tend to be ones that I think, you know, you're just talking earlier about how they're kind of misused and maybe not all that accurate, that kind of thing. So I think it's been one of those gee whiz things that sometimes people try, but I think they often find that they don't work as well as they'd hoped. And I guess the other thing I'd wonder about a little bit, I know at least with some of the less expensive ones, and maybe you have a comment about this, is that because it's measuring conductivity, which is, I assume, is what it's measuring, that if you're fertilizing, how does that affect it? Because it would be the same. Would it pick up on the fact that there's fertilizer and then therefore think that there's more water there than?
Yeah, so we've been looking into, you know, the effects of the, you know, the pH level of the soil on the measurements itself. And we'd really love to do a version of the product that has pH sensing built in so that it has that as a separate variable in the algorithm that we're building. For the initial version, you know, it's just going to do the simple moisture measurement. But that is something that we're thinking about and building into the back end of the system so that when we have that sensing capability, we'll be ready to go.
Yeah. How can pH affect things with fertilizer, et cetera?
Well, I was thinking in particular with fertilizer because it's measuring conductivity, and fertilizer itself is made up of really salts. It'll also show up within conductivity. So, and as therefore, and water does too. And so that's the thing that I've always seen the complaint, at least about some of the cheaper methods of actually sensing for water, is that it's picking up on the, you know, if you just fertilize, it's actually picking up on that. And it's showing that there's a lot more water out there than what there really is. So I guess that's what the thing I was kind of wondering about. But I know for some more expensive units, I know they've kind of solved that problem. So maybe it's just a matter of how it's programmed or
and that's
how
something
it picks up on.
And maybe with a device like PlantLink, you might want to keep that in mind when you are fertilizing.
Right.
That could affect the readout.
Right. It might show as a spike, even though it really is just measuring the fertilizer. So it might be just a matter of just programming it. But.
Well, we are talking about the more expensive devices, and I don't know what sort of price range we're talking about for a product like PlantLink.
Yeah, so PlantLink, you know, the least expensive version that you could get would run you about $69. That would be the base station and one sensor. And you can add additional sensors for about $25 per sensor. If you want to get one of those valves, that would be $65. Right now, that's our pre-order prices.
How many sensors can one base station handle?
The theoretical maximum is around 200.
Okay, so that's that could be a pretty big or at least pretty varied garden.
Absolutely.
Okay. We're taking questions on all manner of gardening and lawn subjects today, and we have one in already. And here it is. I live in an apartment building, and we have a small balcony. I'd like to grow some tomatoes and start a small herb garden. Do your guests have recommendations for the best way to do that? Should I buy a bunch of small pots for the herbs, or is there a better way to do that? And when should one start tomatoes, if you want to do them in pots, that is?
Well, I think probably as long as the one thing, of course, about tomatoes is that they still need sun. So I'm not sure I caught that on whether they have full sun. You really need to have at least 6 to 8 hours of sun. So I don't know how. So hopefully their balcony has sun, because that's going to be one of the issues. Now, for some of the herbs, you can kind of get away with having less sun than that, but tomatoes would be really tough. So that would be the first thing. Make sure there's plenty of sun, at least 6 to 8 hours for the tomatoes. Personally, I like using some of the big self-watering containers, and there's a bunch of brands out there now. Earthbox just happens to be one of those, and it's just really a large container. It does very well. I've done this before with a couple of tomato plants. It actually has – they're called self-watering, but they really just have a water reservoir underneath, and so it makes it really easy to take care of them. So having those bigger containers I think really helps. You could even use like a 5-gallon bucket with holes in the bottom, but I think probably the biggest thing with tomatoes or something, typically you need a big container. There are some smaller tomatoes that are meant to be sort of patio tomatoes. You're not going to get huge crops off of them, but if you're just really wanting a few for your salad or whatever, those work out really well. So they're called patio tomatoes, and those work out nice. There's actually hanging basket tomatoes now, believe it or not, that you can actually grow in hanging baskets. Again, you're not going to, you know, have enough tomatoes to can or anything from these. These are really meant to be kind of just something fresh eating. So those would be fine. If you're starting, if you're starting tomatoes from seed, you'd want to go ahead and do that now. Usually we'd probably do that the 1st of April or so to actually start them from seed indoors. And then once we get past the chance of frost, then you could put them outdoors. So you could do that. Personally, I think the bigger containers, the better. They were asking about small pots. I think the bigger, the better. The smaller the pot, the more you're going to have to water it. So really thinking about maybe doing, and herbs are perfectly happy being in big pots together. They don't have to. You don't have to have individual plants in individual pots, so they'd be quite happy.
Mm-hmm. And Eduardo, just checking, it comes to mind, the plant link is meant for both potted soil and also just outdoors in your garden as well.
That's correct. You can use it in either place.
Okay. Is there a size limitation on the pot where the readings would not come out right?
Not that we've seen so far. You know, it measures the moisture at a specific spot. So it's really just going to tell you the moisture in that area. And then, you know, the pot size itself, like Sandy said, you know, will just help you not have to water quite as often.
Okay. We have a caller on line one, Jim in Champaign. You're on the air on Focus.
Yes. And you guys even touched on the area that it was of interest to me. Just a moment ago, self-watering containers. About 20 years ago, I ran across, I think it was called Planter Technology, and I just looked that up on the Internet, and it looks like they've got a company. There's now an A to Z Planter Technology. But what this thing does is it uses a ceramic cork on a tube, and as the cork dries out, it allows air to go through the tube, and then that allows water out of the reservoir. Hmm. And then that really hinges on the level of the cork. If the higher it is in the pot, the more water goes in. The lower it is, the less water will go in. And I believe they also have something for outdoor works. I haven't spent a lot of time on their website. I just looked that up because of this. But with all respect, there are some interesting alternatives there.
Okay, and this sounds like a way of automatically delivering water. And are you saying that it's a way that is flexible to a plant that might have different levels of soil moisture needs?
Yeah, I will say this: there is something that appeals to me about having part of this electronic, if you were, particularly with a valve, because eventually these reservoirs do run out,
mm-hmm.
and so I would see something applicable for that. And I'm glad to hear that there is something coming along in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for the info. I'll have to check that out.
Thanks. Sure. That's great.
Thank you very much, Jim.
My pleasure.
And, well, it sounds like this is an age-old question that humanity has been applying technology and whatever ideas to. So, Eduardo, wish you best of luck, you and Oso Technologies, on Plant Link. We'll see how it does out there in the marketplace and in people's flower pots and gardens.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we're going to take a short break now, and we'll be back with more lawn and gardening advice from Sandy Mason of the University of Illinois Extension. This is Focus on WYLL. We are back on Focus on WYLL. Ready to take your lawn and garden questions. Sandy Mason is here with the University of Illinois Extension. She is a horticulture expert, and I understand, Sandy, that you have an event coming up with the title of Pollinators and Insecticides, two things that may not go well together.
You know, it really is one. I think even in the popular press, you're reading more and more about the concern, certainly about honeybees, but certainly other pollinators, and then the concern on insecticides. So this is actually a statewide telenet through University of Illinois Extension. And so you can just check with your, wherever you are in Illinois, just check with your local University of Illinois Extension office. And these will be, these are held in most of those offices. And so it's called Pollinators and Insecticides. It's April 23rd at 1 o'clock. You'd actually go into the to your office. The person who is giving the program actually is in another part of the state, and they give the program, and we look at slides and stuff there, and you're able to actually talk with the instructor as well. So it's April 23rd at 1 o'clock, and then it's also held, the same program is again held again at April 25th at 6:30, so in the evening. So in most county offices, and or at least in a lot of the county offices, you have two opportunities to check out that particular program. And then we have a number of them throughout the year as well. One coming up on tomatoes on May 7th, and then one on actually the drought, sort of looking at back and forward on May 21st, where we're sort of looking to see what we might expect with our plants as well after the drought. So the Pollinators Insecticide one is April 23rd.
Okay. Is there someplace online that people could look to get just all the details?
Yeah,
on that?
All they have to do is just search University of Illinois Extension and look at events. They can go to our local website, which is the Champaign Ford Iroquois and Vermilion site. And so pretty much if you just search U of I Extension and then look up the telenets, or it should pop right up to show you all the different ones that are available.
Do you see anything that concerns you directly with your, even with your own gardening, as far as the amount of bees and anybody else that's going to be pollinating flowers out there? Is it a noticeable thing that brings concern to you?
I think it's the thing, you know, I think especially the drought from last year, probably the thing that I noticed the most last year is not, and they aren't necessarily pollinators, but certainly can be, are just the lack of butterflies that we seem to have last year. And I think the drought was really, really tough on a lot of butterflies. That concerns me. I think the other thing for a lot of the pollinators is just the fact that they need, they need a food source out there. So it's not just the fact it's just honeybees, but there are a lot of native insects that also serve as great pollinators. And so they need food sources. So that's why we gardeners, it's real important for us to have a nice selection of plants. And often native plants are the ones that work out best for a lot of the pollinators. And then to have a nice stretch, everything from early spring to late in the summer and into fall. So there's plenty of food out there for them. So I think that's how we can do to really help out the pollinators.
Well, let's go back to the phones and line four, Kathy in Piatt County. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Oh, thank you so much. I have a question about trying to establish prairie grasses like prairie drop seed and little blue stem. And should I be mulching around them when I plant them? Because I have horrible, I'm trying to do, some natural prairie grasses and things, mm-hmm. but the other grass comes up in it. So, but then I read you shouldn't mulch around little blue stems. So when you put them out, and like I have a prairie rose and some other things I'm putting out, should you mulch around them initially to get them started?
Personally, I would, just to get them established. So you're uh-huh. starting out with plants. Typically,
yes.
is
uh-huh.
what you've done. Okay. And then I would. And if you can water them, I know we often think about prairie grasses and stuff being very drought tolerant and stuff. But for a lot of these plants, the fact that we're putting them out as plants, they can use some extra water to get established. Once they're established, they're certainly more drought tolerant. But just to realize if they're baby plants, and certainly after last year, it would have been really tough to try to get anything going. So personally, I would mulch around them. That also tells you where the heck they are out there.
Yeah.
If you've got a bunch of stuff. Now, if you have some cool season types of grasses that are coming in as annuals, like crabgrass or whatever, I don't know, have you coming in?
Yeah.
I'm not sure I'd worry too much about a lot of those, because as you manage your prairie area, a lot of that will be taken care of. They won't tolerate. I don't know if you have this in an area where you can burn or do any other kind of management
uh-huh.
techniques. But a lot of those cool season annual grasses will be taken care of. Foxtail and a lot of those, I just wouldn't worry about too terribly much. But personally, I would go ahead and mulch around them, just a light mulch around them to help keep in some moisture, and then help you to figure out where they are so they can maybe even just do a little weeding or a little watering as well. But
well,
usually they're pretty tough.
Well, also then I had some in a little more established bed, prairie drop seed, and they have really spread.
Yeah.
So are they easy to transplant, the little ones?
Yeah, right.
Because usually prairie plants have such a deep root system.
Yeah, I think those young guys, you can certainly transplant them. You know, some of the bigger plants like prairie dock and some of those are going to be much harder as they age. But usually the little guys, you can do a pretty good job of moving them around. And I will tell you, people, I don't know if people realize that Grand Prairie Friends has their plant sale every May, and it's May 11th this year. So if people are wanting, you know, prairie plants, that's a great opportunity to get them. And that's going to be held at Lincoln Square Village on May 11th. It's a great opportunity.
Oh, thank you. And then really one last question. You were talking about damage to our pollinators and things. So if I try to spot use Roundup, I always feel like I'm killing off butterflies if I use Roundup on some really horrible weeds. Is it really disastrous to like butterflies and things?
Well, I think the one thing with any of the herbicides and stuff that we might be using, Roundup or glyphosate type products, it's one of those things that if you're not spraying it on, you know, the insect itself, obviously you wouldn't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But really, for the most part, you're going to be probably hopefully killing off young plants that you want to get rid of, doing spot applications,
mm-hmm.
And then doing it when they're young, they're not flowering, there wouldn't be a pollinator visiting it anyway, those kinds of things. I think you can be pretty safe when it comes to a lot of the pollinators. But I think, you know, with all the stuff that we do, we have to, you know, obviously read the label, follow the label,
right.
and then go from there.
Okay. Well, thanks so much
uh-huh.
for your help.
Uh-huh. Good luck.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you. And let's go over to line one to Craig in my hometown of Park Forest. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. It's a pleasure. I didn't realize you're from Park Forest, so it's a pleasure to talk to you, Mr. Meadows. So, I wanted to ask, my wife and I have a, you know, you probably ask this question all the time, but my wife and I have a flower box, and it's really popular with cats and squirrels and other small animals, and we're trying to figure out a way to. Just something simple, you know, we don't want to hurt the animals, but
right.
we also don't want them, you know, making a house for themselves, you know, in our flower box. And, you know, I found it's really hard to reason with the local cats and squirrels. You know, they don't seem to understand property rights.
Is this a flower box that's on the ground or up off the ground?
It's up off the ground. It's kind of by our window. It's by our window sill on our front, like on our front porch kind of.
But the animals are climbing up there.
Yeah, it's not very hard for them to jump up there. So.
Yeah, that's and you're absolutely right. It's really a tough thing. So I guess I'd think of a couple things. There are some pepper sprays, this isn't a pepper spray you'd use on somebody, but there are actually pepper products that are meant to keep squirrels away, and you can find it in places that handle bird seed, trying to keep squirrels out of bird feeders and stuff like that. So usually you can find that. That might be something that might be helpful for you, at least for the squirrels, I would hope. Cats, I don't know how cats would work with that particular product. I think the other thing is, does it seem like it's just when you first plant them, or it's like all season long?
It's pretty much all season long.
Oh, okay.
You know, the cats like to use it as, you know, a litter box, and the squirrels just like to dig and
Right. Yeah, the things squirrels do. So I guess I would think of a couple things. If it's all season long, you probably wouldn't want to use it. Sometimes if it's just short term, right after you plant things, sometimes actually just putting a little wire mesh around them just gets them out of the habit of using it. The other thing that I found to be effective is actually to mulch with rock. So you plant them and then you leave a little gap there so that you can use some nice big rocks, you know, big as in like, you know, river rock type size. And then usually if they can't do a lot of good, especially for cats, if they can't do a lot of good digging, then they're not real happy with it anyway. So you might try that. And it actually doesn't look too bad. And I've found that to be fairly effective in containers and stuff where the cats want to dig. So you might try that too. I might do the combination of maybe using the rocks as well as maybe some the red pepper, and then hopefully that'll work out.
Wonderful. Well, thank you both so much. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it. I love your
good
show.
Luck.
Thank you, Craig.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. And I apologize. I seem to have pressed the wrong button here in disconnecting our last caller. I seem to have disconnected all my callers. I do apologize to the two who were waiting, and I invite them and you to call back. Please, we welcome your calls at 333-WILL or 1-800-222-WILL with your lawn and gardening questions for Sandy Mason on Focus on WILL. I do have a question here emailed in, which I have not yet eliminated, and it's a question about arborvita. Am I pronouncing that correct?
Uh-huh.
Well, Bonnie wants to know, because in the last snowstorm, several of her arborvita completely keeled over under the weight of the snow. What can I do, if anything, to help them recover to their upright position, asks Bonnie.
Yeah, I wonder when they keeled over. I don't know if the whole plant fell over. If it seemed like the whole plant fell over, and depending on how old it is, I would try to stake it up. And actually, now that we've gotten some moisture here, usually you can do a pretty good job of the soil's moist enough and the roots are loose enough that you can go ahead and stake it up. That would be one thing. If it just sort of fell apart in all the snow weight, which sometimes we see, that would be another thing. I would just, and this would be short term kinds of things, I'd pull it back together and use something with a very wide webbing, even if it's something like, you know, cloth or something, just to help pull it back together again. And again, short term, you're only going to do this for a month or so and then take it off. And usually that's enough to bring it back. And it is that snow was so heavy. I noticed for a lot of my boxwood and a lot of things, it sort of laid them open. But now they're starting to come back up again, but it may have to take a little bit of physical effort. But just don't leave anything on permanently.
Okay, well, let's go ahead. The calls are starting to come back. I'm going to say hello to line one, Ruth in Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. I just tuned in, so I don't know if you already discussed this or not. I know you just had the discussion about the squirrels and cats. I have huge rabbits in my garden. They're very cute, but they decimate my garden. And I've been able to put fence around my vegetables, but my flower area is so large, and also it butts up against the fence, and so I have a hard time keeping the rabbits away from my tender young shoots of my plants. Is there a good source or reference that I can look at that will tell me fence that rabbits are not interested in?
That plants that they're not interested in? Is that what you said? I'm sorry.
Yes, plants and flowers.
Yeah. Yes, there are. Actually, if you go to the University of Illinois Extension website, there's a little information there. There actually is a really nice site called Living with Wildlife. I'm not sure it really mentions like plants in particular that they're not interested in, but it certainly would give you some more information on sort of how to take care of rabbits, because a lot of people have issues with rabbits, unfortunately, especially this time of year. So that would be one thing. The other thing I would really... you know, for the most part, rabbits are really, this time of year, you know, when a lot of new shoots, sometimes if you can just cover them up at least temporarily. And I love using, I know it's not all terribly pretty necessarily, but I love using like wire cages, the wire baskets that you can get at a lot of the box stores, and you just flip them over. So immediately when I see a rabbit starting to pick on a plant, I just flip that wire basket over the plant. And
good
then let
idea.
It, yeah, and then let it get some growth to it. And then usually I can go ahead and take it off, because it's usually that new growth that they're really, really picking on. And as the plants get bigger and the rabbits sort of disperse, it's not quite so bad. So I would have those at the ready. That would be one thing. There certainly are some repellents, but I'll tell you that, and even with plant selection, sometimes if rabbits are really hungry, they're going to eat right through repellents. And unfortunately, a lot of the young rabbits are sort of just tasting things to see what tastes good. And yeah, so there's some real issues there. Fencing, unfortunately, is going to be one of your best bets, but I've had really good luck using the wire baskets sort of temporarily until we get a little bit growth on the new plants.
Okay, well, thank
that
you
helps.
Very much.
Yeah, yes. No, it's tough.
Thank you.
Or a big dog. I don't know. Big dog? I don't know. That may be next.
Or many cats.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Ruth. And as long as they don't go over after the plants themselves,
yeah,
the dogs and cats can almost also be a challenge. I'm going to take a call on the road until before they get out of range. Line 3, David, calling from the road. You're on the air on Focus.
Hi, thank you very much. We live in the shade in the woods, and I built this beautiful raised garden, of course, and I can't seem to grow any food in it. When we plant tomatoes, they get lots and lots of leaves, and I probably finally get a tomato by the end of October. I heard something where you can force them to fruit or bloom by cutting them back at some point. Does that work, or when do you do that?
Yeah, to be honest with you, I that's probably coming from the idea that sometimes if you stress plants, they will go ahead and flower. But it sounds like, so they're not getting any direct sun at all, ever?
Not when the leaves come out or until the leaves go away on the tree.
Yeah, and so unfortunately, I think it's going to be one of those things that you're really looking at a sunlight issue more than anything.
Yeah.
So I think it just sounds like that may not be a good option for you unless you have another area where you can grow them in containers or something where they get a little bit more sun. You're probably in the shady environments, your best bet is actually look for those vegetables where you're actually eating like the leaves. Leaves or the roots.
Right, like basil or something like
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Or, you know, a lot of the leafies actually do quite well in shade. So things like spinach and kale and,
okay.
You know, a lot of the things where you're just eating the leaves. So I think you're always going to have an issue with any of those plants where you have to rely on them flowering, because most of our plants really, our vegetable plants really need at least, I would say, at least 6 hours of sun. And it sounds like you're not even really close to that.
No.
Yeah, so I think you're always going to struggle.
We'll try the leafy ones. One other question. I had a pepper plant, a habanero pepper plant, and it was in a pot so we could get some sun on it.
Mm-hmm.
Brought it in over the winter,
mm-hmm.
and it's got, you know, 2 feet of leaves all over. It looks good. And I'm wondering, am I supposed to cut that back before I put it out to get a new crop of peppers, or I just put it out as a 2-foot-high pepper plant?
I would say if it still looks nice and healthy, there's no reason why you have to cut it back unless you just plan or don't want it to get any bigger. But you certainly could go ahead and put it outside. I'd probably do it gradually, you know, since you've had it indoors. I'd probably, you know, put it, if you can find it, that sort of halfway house where it's kind of, you know, getting more, a little more sun, a little more colder temperature, you know, a little colder temperatures. You don't want to go through a frost. But wind is going to be an issue. Otherwise, there's really, really, if it's put on any leaves in the wintertime, they'll be so succulent, you'll have problems with them just getting whipped off with the wind. So we try to find that kind of halfway house for a couple of weeks and then put it out. And of course, we're still at that point where we can certainly get cold temperatures. So we're probably looking more like, you know, certainly till probably mid-May or at least the 1st of May. So we have a few more weeks to keep it indoors at least most of the time.
And those leafy crops, to like the basil or spinach or other things, again, probably plant those in May.
No, actually, yeah, basil, yes, you'd have to wait until May, but the leafy stuff like spinach and all that, you know, any of the leaf lettuces, all those things actually take cold temperatures very well, so you could actually go ahead and plant those.
Great. Well, thank you very
much. Uh-huh, good luck.
David, thank you. And we still have a few more minutes left on Focus. Still time for your questions about lawn and garden care for Sandy Mason of the U of I Extension. Contact us at 333-9455. Our call toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 333-WILL, or toll-free at 1-800-222-WILL. One thing I was wondering, Sandy, because it's usually the last thing that makes me certain that it's spring, is when dandelions pop up.
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't popped up yet. I'm not really quite firm as to what time of year they would pop up. I mean, what time of the spring they would pop up. I don't know if that foot of snow we had in Champaign-Urbana 3 weeks ago would play a role. But I assume some people would want to prevent them from popping up as much as possible. Should people be doing things about that now?
If it is one of those things where you're concerned about some of the broadleaf weeds that might be in our lawns, this would be, and certainly dandelions are really getting to that point where they're starting to, a lot of things are, creeping Charlie and violets and a lot of things are coming up. So this would be the time of year people would be thinking about broadleaf weed control if they want to go that route, or crabgrass control. That would be the other thing that they might think about as well. So this would be that time.
Let's go ahead and go on line one to Carl from Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Hi, I was just wondering whether you had any special tricks for getting rid of this terrible creeping ivy that seems to invade from other people's yards. It just keeps going and going and going. I run over it with a lawnmower, but that doesn't do any good. It seems like only getting in there and fighting hand-to-hand get rid of it.
Yeah, I assume you're probably talking about creeping Charlie or ground ivy.
Yes.
Sometimes it's called, yeah. And it, you know, it really is one of those plants that it does very well in shady environments, full sun environments. So it's really a tough plant all in all. So it's one of those things that either, I actually have an area that it grows well underneath the pine trees. There's nothing else growing. So it's perfectly fine for me, and I'm not too worried about it there. It certainly can overtake other plants. So it'd be one of those things if you do decide you really feel like you need to get rid of it and it's in a lawn area, you certainly could use some of the broadleaf herbicides that are available to us. But I will tell you, for it, you have to do a second application with Creeping Charlie, or also called ground ivy. The first application will not do it. So you read the directions on the label of the herbicide. It'll say can reapply in 6 weeks or whatever it might be, and then go ahead and do that second application. And generally, that does a pretty good job, but you can almost guarantee you have to have at least two applications according to the directions on the herbicide. So I will tell you that. So that is one thing. You certainly could dig it out. Live with it. There's different options. Some people say, hey, it's green, I'm going to live with it. So,
great. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Thank you very much, Carl. Let's go out to our next caller on line two. We have a caller from Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yeah, hi. Good morning, Sandy.
Uh-huh.
Last year, we saw that the redbud had a tremendous bloom very early, and then they seeded so much. I mean, the whole tree was full of pods,
mm-hmm.
and not so many leaves. And now this year, I don't know, I can't see anything on my redbud tree. So are a few more trees I saw that they don't have anything yet. But I believe that by mid-April, there should be some activity on some of the things, you know, branches. And I don't see, is it the time that they're dying or something?
No, I think, the redbuds certainly can have issues. But I will tell you, you know, that it was cold. We had March was particularly cold. So a lot of things are a little bit later than they would. And so I really wouldn't worry about it at this point. I've just noticed in the last few days, things are finally starting to pop out. Whereas last year, you know, it was so warm in March, things popped out really early. So I think we're just seeing a little bit difference here because we've had these colder temperatures. Things might be a little bit late, but I certainly would not give up on it. It's way, okay. Yeah, we're way too early to worry about that. So I think you'll find that in the next few days.
Right, because I thought last year it consumed all this energy, and that's it, because it was so much.
Yeah, I know. Absolutely. So no, I would not get, you know, I absolutely would not give up on them at all at this point.
Let it live a little bit. Okay, good.
Yeah, I would just wait. Yeah.
What is the lifespan for the redbud?
Redbuds are not long-lived trees. I will tell you, they're great trees. We love them. They're native. But I would say if you have a redbud that's getting to be about that 45 to 50 years old, that's considered a pretty old redbud.
Oh, I see. Now, mine is about probably 38 years old.
Yeah, so you're probably getting maybe to, you know, it's just a senior citizen at this point, maybe.
Okay, thank you. Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Let's go ahead to line three as we get down to the last couple of minutes of the program. Marley and Mattoon, good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. I have a question, also weed-related. We had some new construction done on the house, and so what happened was it tore up all the existing grass, and unfortunately, we let seeds take over last year. So this year, I want to seed new grass, but I know these seeds are all going to pop up.
Mm-hmm.
How do I plant new seed and still control the weeds that are existing there?
Well, that's a good question. So are these perennial weeds? Have they already started to pop up?
Yes, some, and they are perennials.
Okay. So if there's no good grass there and you want to go this route, you certainly could use one of the non-selective herbicides, things like glyphosate, which is the chemical that's in Roundup and a lot of other products. But and so that's a non-selective herbicide. What you would do is you'd go in as they come up. They have to be coming up. You'd go ahead and kill those off and then go ahead and then you can reseed right into that. Now, that'll take care of the perennial stuff that's already visible, that's already come up. It'll take care of that. Seeds and stuff you'd have to sort of deal with later on. typically, because we just don't have a lot of chemicals that are really good at letting the good seed germinate and not letting the bad seed germinate. So that may be one of your options. I'd probably kill off the perennial stuff, and then within a week to 10 days, you can actually go ahead and reseed right into it.
Okay.
And then sort of deal with the other weeds later on as time goes on.
Okay. And one other question, if I may. We live in the country, but I also have city water. I have an existing well that has been tested and has E. coli and coliform bacteria. And so if I water my garden with that, I'm worried about it getting into the food supply.
I think you should worry about that.
Okay.
Were you given a recommendation on how, usually it's a matter of just treating your well water? I think you need to check with your public health, because typically it can be done either with bleach or something else. But I would check with them on dealing with that water issue.
Well, I could use city water, and it's already chlorinated, but is that okay to put on a garden?
Sure. You could certainly use city water. But I think it'd be great if you could use your well water. But I wouldn't just give up on it, but I would not use it as it is with your well water.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. And I'm afraid that's where we have to close it off for today. My apologies to Frank and Urbana, who had been waiting patiently to ask you a question. You can still send in a question or a comment on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. And our thanks to Sandy Mason
with the
University of Illinois Extension for coming on Focus today. And thanks also to Eduardo Torrealba of Oso Technologies for coming on the show earlier in the hour to talk about PlantLink. And there's a link to that product information on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Monday on Focus, we'll be talking about the new supercomputer at the University of Illinois, Blue Waters, with Bill Gropp with the U of I's Institute for Advanced Computing Applications and Technologies. This is Focus on WYLL.